Georgi Markov was born near Sofia, Bulgaria in 1929, and after studying chemical engineering, became a teacher at a technical college. He also dabbled in writing. This was just after World War II, in a time when Bulgaria, as well as most of Eastern Europe, came under the communist rule of the Soviet Union. There was great fear of fascism and the Nazis, as well as the widespread civil and social destruction that marked post-war Europe, that apparently led many people to think that communism, rather than capitalism, would help the European economy. After 1954, when communist Todor Zhivkov became the leader of Bulgaria, Georgi Markov's avocation as a playwright and author began to expand into more subversive and dissident writings, particularly against communism. Markov won literary awards in his native Bulgaria, but increasingly, especially during the Cold War era of the 1960s, the author's political and satirical writing won disapproval from the strict government. Markov felt pressure to leave Bulgaria and ultimately settled in London in the early 1970s with a job as a commentator on BBC Radio. His weekly program, Distant Reports About Bulgaria, caused him to be censored in his home country and led Zhivkov to order Markov to return back to Bulgaria. Markov refused and was granted political asylum by Great Britain, where he continued his work at the BBC and Radio Free Europe despite being convicted in absentia in Bulgaria. Zhivkov made a decision that he had to find a way to stop Markov's anti-communist broadcasts. So he enlisted the help of his Minister of the Interior, General Dmitry Stoyanov. The pair gave Markov the code name Wanderer, sometimes seen translated as Vagrant. And in June of 1977, General Stoyanov submitted a lengthy report to the Soviet Union's Politburo about, quote, the enemy emigration, end quote, that he saw occurring out of Bulgaria and its damaging ramifications on state security. A secret agreement was made giving General Stoyanov permission on behalf of Bulgarian leader Zhivkov to contact Yuri Andropov, who was at that time head of the KGB, which was the Soviet Union's security agency. The KGB was to give, quote, technical support in the killing of Georgi Markov. In early 1978, Markov began receiving phone threats. And although he didn't seem too concerned, he did mention them to his co-workers at the BBC. By the summer of 1978, Markov felt the threats were becoming more serious and increasingly sinister. The alleged final threat stated, quote, "You will not become a martyr. You will simply die of natural causes. You will be killed by a poison that the West cannot detect or treat." On Bulgarian leader Zhivkov's 67th birthday, September 7, 1978, while Markov waited at London's Waterloo Bridge bus station, headed to work, he suddenly felt a stinging pain in the back of his right thigh. He turned around and saw a heavyset man behind him bend over and pick up an umbrella. The stranger muttered sorry with a thick accent before getting into a taxi. When Markov got to work, he mentioned what had happened to his co-workers. Now that evening, Markov noticed redness and swelling on the back of his thigh where he had felt that stinging sensation earlier. He developed a high fever throughout the night, and Markov was admitted to the hospital the next day. The doctors were stumped by his symptoms. Their original diagnosis was blood poisoning. The thinking was he had developed septicemia from some kind of bacterial infection. But Markov died 3 days later, on September 11, 1978, age 49, of massive heart and organ failure, leaving behind a wife and two-year-old daughter. Because of what Markov had reported to co-workers and police, Scotland Yard ordered that he receive a full autopsy, which was conducted at a public mortuary in London the next day. Forensic pathologists noted fluid in his lungs, commonly seen when the heart is failing, and small hemorrhages dotted many of Markov's organs. His liver showed the signs of poisoning, but toxicology uncovered no obvious lethal substance in his body. An examination of Markov's blood showed extremely high white cell counts, the kind often seen in serious bacterial or viral infections, or in cases of drug toxicity and other disorders that cause severe physical stress. During tissue sampling, a block of flesh was removed from the back of Markov's right thigh, around the site of the initial injury. In it, forensic scientists discovered a tiny metal pellet, about 1.5 millimeters in diameter. That's slightly smaller than a pinhead. The pellet itself was pretty sophisticated. It was made of 90% platinum and 10% iridium, and was later discovered to be a watchmaker's bearing. It had two tiny round tunnels drilled through it by a laser in an X-shaped pattern that intersected in the middle. The pellet had no clear traces of a poison, but the doctors suspected it had contained some type of natural toxin that dissipated it in Markov's body. By process of elimination, ricin seemed the most likely poison. Investigators figured that the ricin was put into the holes in the pellet, and then the platinum was coated in something. The coating had to be a substance that melted when it reached body temperature, allowing the toxin to enter Markov's bloodstream. Ricin is a naturally occurring substance produced in castor beans and can be isolated during the extraction of castor oil from the beans. Although the oil itself is easily extracted from the plant, the ricin is much more difficult to purify into a form that can be used as a poison. An amount of ricin as tiny as a few crystals of table salt can kill an adult. Ricin is a slow-acting toxin, and it mimics other illnesses or infections. At the time of Markov's poisoning, there was no known antidote, although since then some antitoxins have been developed by the UK and US militaries, but those have had very limited human testing so far. In terms of how it acts on living cells, ricin first penetrates the cell membrane and then prevents the cell from manufacturing proteins. These proteins include necessary enzymes, some hormones, and other important biological molecules. Due to its effects on cells, which make up all of our body tissues, the eventual result of ricin poisoning is complete organ failure and death. German scientist Peter Stillmark first found ricin to be toxic in 1888. Later, during World War I, ricin was actually considered as a possible weapon of mass destruction, but was discovered not to be a good choice for two main reasons. It can't tolerate extremely high temperatures of over about 176 degrees Fahrenheit, and at that time, there was absolutely no antidote. Ricin poisoning has been used or attempted in small-scale terrorist and assassin operations like the one that killed Georgi Markov. In fact, in 2013, ricin-laced letters were sent to U.S. President Barack Obama, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and a gun control group. Now, small-time actress Shannon Guess Richardson allegedly sent the letters, hoping to frame her estranged husband as having sent them. Now, back to the Markov case. Another reason investigators suspected ricin as the poison in the Markov case, and why they believed a coating of some type had to be used, relates to another Bulgarian exile named Vladimir Kostov. He was living in Paris and also working as a Radio Free Europe correspondent. Like Markov, the Bulgarian Secret Service was asked after Kostov and had given him the code name Judas. That's because Kostov had once worked as a Bulgarian intelligence officer. About 2 weeks before Markov's assassination, Kostov was getting off of an escalator in a Paris metro station when he felt something sting him on the back. He had no idea what happened, but went to the doctor within hours. Kostov's physician told him it might have been a wasp, since he couldn't feel anything under the man's skin. Later that day, Kostov developed a high fever, and the area on his back got painful and swollen. He went to a different doctor who told him the wound didn't look like a wasp sting, but he had no idea what it was. Fortunately for Kostov, his fever went away and he got better. But when fellow Bulgarian exile Georgi Markov was killed and Kostov heard the story, he went to the French authorities and requested they investigate whether what had happened to him 2 weeks before Markov's death could somehow be connected. At that point, Kostov was taken into protective custody and given a more thorough medical exam. X-rays revealed a small metal pellet lodged between his rib and the skin of his back. Under local anesthetic, a surgeon removed a thumb-sized chunk of skin surrounding the foreign object. A detective from Scotland Yard took the tissue sample containing the pellet back to England, where forensic scientists analyzed it. The pellet was identical to the one that had earlier been found in Markov's body and had traces of a sugary wax on its surface, which, since it hadn't melted, may have saved Kostov's life. Blood tests on Kostov showed traces of antibodies to ricin, meaning his white blood cells had created defenses to fight the poison. He just hadn't been exposed to enough of it to kill him, as it had Markov. After the USSR fell apart in 1991, it was discovered that Soviet technicians, perhaps working in the KGB poison laboratory known as the Chamber, had developed a modified umbrella that could be used as a type of syringe to inject something like the pellet used on Markov. But some sources think the umbrella may have just served as a distraction, while the poison pellet was delivered into his thigh by some kind of syringe. There was no real damage to the jeans Markov wore, and no evidence of any type of residue indicating the pellet had been injected, say, with an explosive of some type. Maybe the man behind Markov just bent down so his face wouldn't be seen and injected Markov with some kind of syringe while picking up the umbrella. In Kostov's case, he didn't see an umbrella, but he did say that when he felt the sting in his back, he heard the clattering sound of something small hitting the escalator. The sound was also reported by his wife. In either case, in a crowded setting like a public transportation hub, a certain amount of bodily contact is expected. Just a simple jostle could easily conceal whatever injection method was used to introduce pellets into both Markov and Kostov. Plus, such close proximity would ensure no mistaking or missing the target, and it wouldn't harm bystanders. The London police have been trying to solve the Markov murder for decades. Of course, they got no help from Bulgaria until the end of communist rule there in 1989. But Bulgaria conducted widespread destruction of records in early 1990 before the new government took over, which would have included any paperwork related to Markov's assassination. In January of 1993, though, a likely suspect was discovered, a guy by the name of Francesco Galino, a Danish national of Italian descent who was living and working as an antiques dealer in Copenhagen. Galino admitted to working for the Bulgarian secret police under the code name Agent Piccadilly, but denied being involved in Markov's killing. Authorities recruited Galino after he was caught twice smuggling drugs into Bulgaria. They apparently set him up with an alias and a job in Denmark in exchange for conducting espionage for them in Western Europe. Galino was the only Bulgarian spy known to be in London at the time of the assassination, but investigators haven't been able to gather enough evidence to indict him. The Markov case is still open in England, but in 2008, the statute of limitations expired in Bulgaria, so officials there haven't pursued the case any further. Now, I don't know about you, but I really didn't recognize the name Olof Palme until recently. If you're a political history buff, you may be quite familiar with the man. But if you're a reader of modern fiction, you may have heard of his name first, or at least became more curious about Palme after reading The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. That novel and its sequels were set in Sweden and include historical references, including events involving Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. Palme was born in Stockholm in January of 1927 to a wealthy conservative family. After attending the University of Stockholm for a few years, he received a scholarship to finish his bachelor's degree in 1948 at Kenyon College in my home state of Ohio. The topic of his undergraduate thesis was the United Auto Workers Labor Union, known as the UAW. After graduation, Palme spent time in Detroit working with the head of the UAW. He also traveled throughout the United States, Mexico, and later visited several third world countries where he witnessed many forms of social injustice that greatly influenced his political life. After returning to the University of Stockholm to earn his law degree, Palma became a very active member of the Social Democratic Party of Sweden. In 1953, the Prime Minister of Sweden recruited Palma as his secretary. He steadily moved up the ranks and was ultimately elected leader of the Social Democratic Party. When Prime Minister Erlander resigned in 1969, King Gustav VI appointed Palma the new Prime Minister of Sweden. Incidentally, several years later, under Palma's rule, a parliamentary form of democratic government was established and the constitutional power of the king was removed. How's that for a thank you? Throughout his career, Olof Palme was dedicated to, quote, socialism, peace, and solidarity, and was a frequent critic of both Russian and U.S. policies. He was against war in general, including the U.S.-Vietnam War, and he accepted U.S. Army deserters into Sweden. Despite that, Palme became a supporter of the Palestine Liberation Organization, known as the PLO, led by Yasser Arafat. That was a group the U.S. considered a radical terrorist organization until the early 1990s. Needless to say, Palme had strong political opinions and made many enemies as well as close allies. In fact, by way of some titillating trivia, one of those close associates was U.S. actress and political liberal Shirley MacLaine. She met Prime Minister Palme at an anti-Vietnam War conference in New York, and the two began a long-term love affair, despite the fact that each was married. While he was prime minister, Palme enacted lots of governmental changes with the welfare of the people in mind. But in order to adopt those reforms, he significantly raised taxes. This probably led to his loss in the 1976 election, ending 40 years of continual rule by the Social Democratic Party. Still, Palme remained very involved with the party and also served as a United Nations mediator in the early 1980s during the Iran-Iraq War. In 1982, Palme was re-elected Prime Minister of Sweden. He's quoted as having once said, "I know that the Thatchers and the Reagans will be out in a few years. We have to survive till then." Given he was a fairly controversial and outspoken leader of a large European country, Palme was not as concerned with security as he probably should have been. He often went out without bodyguards and not only to sneak around with Shirley MacLaine. On the afternoon of February 28th in 1986, Palme's wife, Lisbeth, called their grown son, Martin, from her office and talked about seeing a movie together that night. That evening at 8:30, Olof and Lisbeth left their apartment in Stockholm without their bodyguards, for a short walk to the metro station, where then they would travel to the theater and meet Martin and his wife. After the show, the couple separated, and Olof and Lisbeth started walking back to the station. At 11:21, a man wearing dark clothes and a ski mask came up behind them and shot the prime minister in the back at point-blank range. He fired a second shot at Mrs. Palme, but she sustained only a superficial wound, and the gunman ran off. Some witnesses reported seeing a car carrying two other men that picked up the assailant, but no one got the vehicle's license number. An ambulance rushed Palme to the hospital, but he was pronounced dead at 12:06 on the morning of March 1, 1986, age 59 years. The only pieces of forensic evidence recovered in the case were bullets of the Winchester Western 357 variety that were removed from the victims' bodies. The composition of the bullets was consistent with lead fragments in the clothing of both Prime Minister Palme and his wife. No bullet casings were recovered from the scene, which led police to believe the gun was a revolver, since they don't eject casings. The most common guns that use those types of bullets are several varieties of U.S.-manufactured Smith & Wesson 357 Magnums. As part of the investigation, police searched Palme's apartment and both Lisbeth and Martin's office to try to locate any wiretapping equipment. If someone had been listening in on their conversations on the day of the murder, they would have known where and when to find the prime minister without his bodyguards. But no surveillance equipment was found at any of the locations they searched. There have been claims, though, that the police work at the scene was sloppy and inadequate. It's even been alleged that right-wing members of the Swedish police force could have actually been involved in the assassinations. In 1988, a man named Christer Peterson became a suspect. Peterson was a known drug addict and criminal who had been previously convicted of manslaughter in a 1970 stabbing death. Lisbeth Palma picked Peterson out of a police lineup, and he ended up being convicted mainly on her testimony. But less than a year later, Peterson was released for lack of evidence, especially since no weapon had been found. At one point, Peterson actually confessed to shooting the prime minister, but then recanted, saying he may have not done it. He just couldn't really remember. In 2004, Peterson died of a brain hemorrhage after an epileptic seizure. He remains the only person ever arrested for the murder of Olof Palme. Now, it's been claimed that over 500 Smith & Wesson revolvers have been test-fired in order to make bullet comparisons to the slugs recovered from the Palmas' bodies. In 2006, a tip led police to a lake in central Sweden where they found a .357 Smith & Wesson. Based on its serial number, they figured out the gun had been stolen in a home burglary and then used in a 1983 post office robbery. Authorities had high hopes when they sent it to Sweden's National Lab of Forensic Science. But in 2007, it was announced the gun was too corroded to provide any type of confident comparison. Well over 100 theories and suspects have been brought up during the investigation of the Palme assassination. He vehemently opposed racism in South Africa, and several apartheid supporters have been named as suspects, but no evidence have been found to link any of them to the crime. There's also been speculation that Israeli Zionist Mossad assassins killed Palme due to his longstanding support of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Palme granted asylum to Chilean refugees after a coup overthrew President Salvador Allende in 1973. So right-wing Chilean fascists have also been implicated in Palma's death. The Yugoslavian Secret Service was known to have been following Palme and have also been suspected. Same with the Kurdish PKK separatist movement in Turkey. There's even been discussion of possible U.S. Central Intelligence Agency involvement since Palme spoke out against the events that developed into the U.S.-Iran-Contra scandal. Palme clearly made a collection of enemies over the years. Some groups have even claimed responsibility for his killing, but nothing's been proven. Sweden used to have a 25-year statute of limitations on murder, but that's been lifted because of the Palme case, which remains open to this day. Now, a few minutes ago, I mentioned Yasser Arafat, who was the leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization from 1969 to 2004. Arafat was born in Cairo, Egypt, in 1929, the same year as Georgi Markov, and just 2 years after the birth of Olof Palme. So all three of those men were contemporaries. They were all about the same age during events like World War II, the rise of communism, the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and their allies, as well as the political conflicts in the Middle East that still boil today. Although Arafat was born in Cairo, his father was a Palestinian from the Gaza Strip. His mother was from Jerusalem, and after she died when Arafat was only 4 years old, he was sent to the old city of Jerusalem to be raised by relatives. He was in Jerusalem for several years before returning to Cairo. There, Arafat dug into studies of Judaism and Zionism to try to understand the conflicting viewpoints, but ultimately he became an Arab nationalist and began to help smuggle arms into Palestine, which at that point was under British control. During the Arab-Israeli War of 1948, Arafat aligned himself with the Muslim Brotherhood. And as a newly graduated civil engineer, Arafat was called to fight in the 1956 Suez Crisis, in which Egypt stood up to Britain, France, and Israel over control of the Suez Canal. Arafat was part of the Fedayeen guerrilla force in Gaza that was thrown out when President Nasser of Egypt allowed the United Nations to take over the disputed area. Arafat went to Kuwait, where he and other Palestinians, some of whom were members of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, founded the Fatah movement. Now, Fatah's ideology was to have Palestinians take back their land on their own, not through support from any established Arab government. They financed their efforts by making alliances with major businessmen, particularly those in the oil trade. In the early 1960s, Arafat moved to Syria and began to persuade fighters from the Palestinian Liberation Organization's military arm to join him. From there, he crossed into the Jordanian-occupied West Bank to recruit even more supporters. Regardless of where they lived, Palestinians were increasingly being drawn to Arafat and the Fatah's Palestinian solution. That's the one that would take back the land they saw as theirs. By 1969, Arafat had become the chairman and leader of the PLO, and for many decades he moved throughout the Middle East, serving as the international symbol of the Palestinian struggle for independence. Arafat alternated between negotiation and violence in his politics, and by the early 1990s had made his way back into the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. After the secret Oslo Accord led to the official signing of the Israeli-Palestinian Declaration of Principles in Washington, D.C., Arafat shared the 1994 Nobel Peace Prize with two Israeli officials. But within years, he participated in further violence against Israeli occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. Ultimately, the Israelis took his Ramallah compound under siege, and Arafat was held there in confinement beginning in 2002. In October of 2004, at 75 years old, Arafat suddenly fell ill with what was thought to be stomach flu, so he was airlifted to a military hospital in France. He went into a coma and died about a month later. The official cause of death was ruled to be a massive brain hemorrhage that resulted in stroke. Despite questions surrounding his death, including rumors of a possible poisoning, his wife, Suha, didn't allow an autopsy. But 8 years after his death, in the summer of 2012, an Al Jazeera television station apparently convinced Mrs. Arafat to provide them some of her husband's belongings. The items had been used by Arafat during his one-month illness and included a hat containing some of his hair, Arafat's toothbrush, and clothing with some of his urine and blood stains on it. Reference samples of some of Arafat's belongings used prior to his illness were also gathered. All this evidence was sent to a forensic laboratory in Switzerland. The Swiss Institute of Radiation Physics found levels of the radioactive poison polonium-210 in Arafat's clothing. That's the same toxin that was used in the highly publicized 2006 poisoning a former KGB spy, Alexander Litvinenko. Polonium is one of the rarest elements in nature. It's usually made with a particle accelerator or in a nuclear reactor. And although it can't pass through the skin, an amount the size of just one grain of sand can kill a person if they ingest it. Toxicologists agreed that the time frame typical of polonium poisoning correlated well with Arafat's one-month illness before his death. Some were skeptical, though, saying polonium's short half-life would have made it undetectable within several years after exposure. Some said the polonium was planted in Arafat's belongings long after his death to try to implicate the Israelis. The lab itself admitted there was no good chain of custody for the items brought to them through Arafat's widow. But Palestinian officials had always suspected the Israelis poisoned Arafat. So after the polonium discovery, the investigation into his death was reopened with the full blessing of Suha Arafat and current PLO leader Mahmoud Abbas. Mrs. Arafat went on the record saying only a country with access to nuclear elements could have carried out this poisoning. Although Israel is not one of the 8 nuclear state nations, it's widely believed that Israel does have nuclear capabilities. Still, given that Arafat was holed up in his West Bank compound for over 2 years before he died, interacting with fellow Palestinians, it's hard to imagine how the poison could have been slipped into his food or drink. Despite cultural taboos and great statements of protest, in November of 2012, several teams of forensic experts went to Yasser Arafat's mausoleum in the West Bank city of Ramallah. It was decided that the remains would be sampled and teams from Switzerland, Russia, and France would independently analyze Arafat's tissues in their respective forensic labs. The grave was closed the same day after the sampling of his body took place. In November of 2013, a year after the exhumation, the Swiss scientists reported that Arafat was likely poisoned by polonium. Traces of the poison were found both in the PLO leader's body and in the soil around his remains. The Swiss reported amounts of polonium found in his rib were in the range of 18 to 36 times greater than incidental values. Then, a month later, the results of the Russian testing were revealed. Their lab found absolutely no traces of polonium in Arafat's tissues. As for the French lab, well, it did find traces of polonium, but ruled they were at natural levels, likely due to environmental influences, not poisoning. So despite exhuming Arafat's body and testing by three different laboratories, his death has so far not been proven an assassination, and his cause of death still remains a forensic mystery. But maybe that depends on who you ask.